George Braithwaite, Reminiscences of Mining Engineer Barrow, recorded by Chris Jones on the 5th, 2nd, 1982, for the Cumbria Immunity Trust Mines History Society Archive, number A47.
Maintenance and one thing and another.
How many pits were there then at Roanhead?
At Roanhead, during their 30s was the period I was there, from about 29 to 41. In operation, mainly Nigel Pit on its last level.
Yeah.
That was the main producer of 90%. Round about 1929 and 30, Rita was still working.
Yeah.
And there was a bit of ore drawn out from both Billy and Burton pits. They were following a narrow seam, hoping it would lead to something.
Yeah.
Which it never did. But the shafts, there were shafts that were with a winding engine operating at Nigel, Rita, Kathleen, Billy, Burton, and Violet, which was the main pumping engine. They had a hybrid beam engine, a horizontal one, a compound engine made by Hawthorne Davy. The low pressure cylinder was 6 foot diameter, and the high pressure would be somewhere around about 3 feet, I couldn't tell you exactly. But it would run, it had a 9 foot stroke, and it ran 4.5 strokes a minute.
Very slow, in fact, isn't it?
And it had the bell cranks, or L legs as they were commonly called, connected with a beam, a jumbo beam that worked and worked like that. And 14 inch square diameter, square timbers, roughly about 700 or 800 feet deep, strapped together. So they're about 30 foot long with these timbers. They also always had 3 or 4 in reserve in Bert Bolton Haywood's timber merchants at Cavendish Dock in Barrow. They always had some in reserve in there, pitch pine. And so Violet was mainly a pumping station. It had they had drawn ore from it, but nothing my period I was there. And Violet, Rita and Kathleen were all interconnected, and so they didn't pump at Rita or Kathleen.
They wound there.
They wound there, but Rita not in my time. Rita was, yes, but not at Kathleen in my time.
What were the engines there?
But the engines there, the pumping engine, was a true beam engine, which they used in emergency when the main one at Violet broke down. That was only just used as a standby.
Where was that built?
I couldn't tell you where that one was built, I'll be honest about that. Most of the beam engines were Davy engines.
Yeah.
There are also pits that had been taken over from British Barrow Hematite, because the pits were also near, that when Barrow Hematite stopped work round about 1928, I would say, just before I went there, Kennedy Brothers, Roanhead Mines, took over their pumping to prevent their own pits being flooded.
Yeah.
And there was a steam engine down a pit which we called the new shaft, which would really had belonged to Barrow Hematite. It had a steam Davy engine underground, and the steam was piped. It wasn't pretty deep, about 300 feet. The steam was piped down from the surface boiler.
isn't it?
But that was discontinued about 1930, and Rowan had put the first pump of its type into this in this country, down at 300, with the electric pump with the motor on the top and the pump 300 foot down with 300 feet of shafting driving it, so that in emergency the motor never got flooded and it didn't matter if the pump did. And that was made by could switch it off a minute while I think of that. I don't should know it. Canadian firm, the first that you came over to this country, Hull or Scotland. It was 300 feet of vertical shafting, running internally in their 18 inch diameter cast iron pipes. About 20 foot long these pipes were. And this was supported on lignovita bearings every second joint, really, every 40 feet. And that replaced the steam engine made by Davies. It was the underground.
They bring that one up, or did they?
That was left there until round about 1937 or 8, when they began to get a drive for scrap iron. And that was broken up down below and then brought out for scrap. And so therefore there was a winding engine there, a little electric one. There was never any oil drawn up in during my period there, which would be about 12 years. The drawn head had been one of the pioneers in the engineering side, as in fact as they manufactured their own design of winding engine. From as long back as a miniature one that they exhibited in the Paris exhibition, I think it was 1877, somewhere around about there, and it was lying derelict in the loft of the engineering shop, a little model one that they'd built, and they built all their own. There were second motion engines, if you know what I mean by that, insofar as they weren't direct driven, there was a gear wheel, a big pinion wheel, and a big cog wheel on the end of the drum, winding drum. Then in round about 1930, just after I started, I put a big one in that they bought second hand, a first motion engine that came from Little Crow Garth up in Cumberland. And that was the main winding engine for Nigel, and that was a direct first motion. That was the only one that they didn't make themselves. The others, during my time, we didn't actually make any. But there's enough lying derelict round the place to cannibalise for any spares we wanted. On that bottom level at Nigel, round about 1935, for the last 5 years or so it operated, there was a haulage rope put in to do away with the bogey boys that were running the bogies on the level. There's a washing and screening plant there. It's washed and screened the second class ore, really, and the term for it was kibbled ore, which is really squared, really, and which went mainly to Sheffield for annealing the ingot molds, steel ingot molds.
What was the haulage?
The haulage motor was electric. They'd gone all electric during the period I was there. I was told, and I quite think this is right, that the first electricity generated in furnace was at Roanhead Mines by one of their own winding engines converted through belt drive to a dynamo, DC of course. And when I first went there, they had a Bellis and Morecambe triple expansion steam engine on a dynamo. And then they were persuaded by the Para Corporation, who were the people who generated in this area, to go onto AC current. And the Para Corporation supplied, free of charge, all the electric motors that were necessary to convert all the little pumps and one thing and another. You got those supplies for using their electricity. Very different to what it is today.
Yeah, right.
And just as a by comment, the same that happened with the gas people. We had a gas cooker fitted at our house, and that was the same principle.
The gas.
The railway crossing had gas in. The more gas appliances you had, the more you used,
yeah,
and it was simple as that, and they were supplied to encourage you to.
They built a gas boiler and
enclosed it.
A
galvanised bath and enclosed it in, you know, to. These brass balls were the old bells before they fitted electric bells in the winding houses. There's a third one on there, and during my time I fitted electric bells into the winding houses, and of course these were redundant, and so I got one or two polished up and in the air today. Where have we got to?
Well, we were.
That was the shafts, how shall we say, there was what they call a double winding shaft and a single at Nigel.
Yeah.
Double one up, one down, and of course the single one just went down, and there was nothing at the reverse end, it just went up.
Was there a ladder shaft next to it?
There wasn't a ladder shaft at Nigel, but further over in the direction of Sandscale on the shore, there's a ventilation shaft where there's a ladder down there.
That
was the escape way. When I went to there in 1929, the pumping engines down below were were electric, piston type. But the last three levels were electric turbo pumps made by Mather and Platt. They were 8 stages and 9 stages and 10 stages. As they got deeper and deeper, they wanted an extra stage to pump the extra height.
What depth was this?
They got down, I would say, Nigel, round about 120, 130 fathom. I would say that's sort of 700 or 800 feet without doing, get a conversion table out somewhere in that region. We were talking about the new shaft with the pump that was on the surface, with the motor on the surface and the pump down below. And I forgot the name, it still hasn't come to me. But there's an interesting point that when they took the old Davis steam engine out, which was the standby for that, before they took it out, we put another electric pump down. And it was rather unique, as was the motor that drove the pump was 3,000 volts right off the main. It was an awful struggle to get switchgear that was small enough, with the high quality of insulation necessary in those days, to go down the 4 foot square shafts. It was managed eventually. And there's an interesting story. If you can find this fellow's when he retired, his name will be, it was Bernard, he was a borough electrical engineer. Before we put this pump in, we got in touch with Bernard, the borough engineer, electrical engineer, to see what their reaction would be to this sudden surge on his power lines. So he's just, his answer was, and when will this be installed? On being told, he says, oh well, carry on, not to worry, I'll be retired by then. So that was a typical corporation or yes, that, just as a matter of interest, that Bernard's son finished up as Admiral Bernard and commanded the illustrious aircraft carrier that was built at Barrow. It's just a little sideline. And then, of course, that Davy pump was pulled out and broken up a bit afterwards. Reverting back to the Haythorn Davy, which was a horizontal engine at Violet, it pumped about 1,000 gallons a minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So there was water down there.
There was an awful lot of water. They always said it had a big advantage over the turbine type electric pumps, as insofar as if they got any sand, which used to would scour the fast running turbine pumps to pieces, all they did with these, which was a bucket type pump, was open a valve about halfway up the column, giving 300 or 400 pounds pressure of water, and stir the sand up. And they would pump it. If it ever got silted up, they just stirred the sand up and it came up by releasing the pressure from about halfway up. And
there was a ladder shaft next to it.
There was a ladder shaft next to it. I never walked that ladder shaft, but the one at the new shaft, which I once climbed up that one. 300 feet, all vertical. Slimy shaft, the steam engine broke down.
That's a metal ladder?
No, all timber ladders, homemade. Sides of the ladder, well, the rungs of the ladder were just about 2 inch by inch, notched into the vertical sides. Just notched in a nail, one nail in each end.
And what, they went down in stages, presumably?
They went down in stages of perhaps 50, 60 feet of time before there was a little platform.
Yeah.
But there was quite a few ladder shafts adjacent to the shafts, but that was the only one I ever had much experience of.
For the going back to Nigel, mm-hmm. What were the winding arrangements there? It was a double shaft, was it?
There was like a double shaft that's 1 8-foot by 4 divided into two, so that one cage could come up while the other one was going down.
Did they use the same cage for men as?
They use the same cage for men as for the oar, and also side by side with it, there's a single shaft, so that was like really a treble shaft at Nigel. On those photographs, it's Nigel Foot, you might be able to just pick out those three.
Yeah.
And having said that, if that was the bottom level, they did sink a little inclined shaft a little bit further, but it was only an inclined walk down shaft, like a drift, a bit lower. In, as if the body of oil was coming in and then going off it a little.
They worked Nigel out, didn't they?
They worked Nigel out. But when you're asking that question, just reminds me, I might as well say, to the best of my knowledge, and it would be true because a chap called Shepherd Rigg, who was my predecessor as foreman at Runhead, had been the engineer for Barra Hematite. And he said the only one of all their workings where there's any oil left was Anticross at Dalton, and that was closed due to the high amount of water and the poor price of the ore in the early 30s,
because they were getting copper out of there, isn't
there? There was traces of copper, and I think it was Yalside, there were traces of silver and of gold, but never anything to be anything like a commercial proposition, but this is a little bit I have been told, that there was these little traces.
Because that could be Anticross that's caused that subsidence in the football field.
No, I'm saying no, but if the football field is anything like where I think it is over the other side of the Dalton Station. And all that area is riddled with old mines, both sides of the main road and both sides of the railway line that runs from Dalton to Wolverston. There was air pits on the left-hand side above where the Dalton played rugby. But I think the soccer people are over the other side up Stainton
Road.
Right,
Stainton Road, isn't it?
Yes. Going up over Stainton Crags, as my good wife would call it. No, I would say have nothing to do with Anticross, no.
You say you've been down some of the Lindell.
I was down one of the Lindell pits when I was apprenticed at the Ulverston Iron Works. They had been closed down, but they had a caretaker mine captain there just looking after things, and he wanted some pipe work attending to, and I was sent from North Lancashire Iron Works.
Which pit was that?
Now, I couldn't tell you. I wasn't greatly interested in the mines at that time, you know what I mean, just a young apprentice and one thing and another, and went down the tongue in the cheek, you know, having never been down before, a bit apprehensive.
You went down in a cage, did you?
Yes. So yes, I think it was, I'm nearly sure it was, a hand windlass, no steam. I just wondered.
How far down did you go?
Oh, I haven't a clue. Too far in those days. And that would be round about 28, 29, somewhere, 20, somewhere in that period.
Yeah.
No, before, not 29, 20, 27, 28, I'll connect, miss.
Yeah.
And that mine captain was called Ullock. 42nd cousin of some of my older generation. That it happened. That was coincidence. All those broken grounds that are there now, where they're flooded, they all had little pumping cabins down there where they pumped down.
Where
at now? Well, all those Violet, Broken Ground, Rita, which is all one, the park north where the fishery, Taylor has his fishery place, those all had pumping places down, and while the Northwestern Water Authority were boasting about the way they drained, was it Harlock or Poker Beck Reservoir this summer, with a pump on a raft, they were first known. They were a long, long way behind. Most of those broken grounds had pumps on the raft that rose and fall with their water.
Yeah.
They were 40 or 50 years behind the times with those. Oh, Goldmire Quarry, where at Thwaite Flat, the one where the big controversy is now about extending it.
Yeah.
But Goldmire Quarry had originally belonged to Millermire, where it's where they got the limestone for the flux for the smelting. But Longdrum Askham and Askham Ironworks was taken over by Millam, and Askham Ironworks was closed, and so during my time. Goldmire Quarry was Millam. But the beck that runs down through Thwaite Flat, which is Red Beck that comes down through Furness Abbey, if it ever got too high, it flooded those meadows, and the water would percolate through to the workings at Runhead. And so they had a Petter paraffin engine with a little pump attached at Goldmire. They found it cheaper to pump the surface water there than let it percolate through the ground and then having to pump it up from 300 or 400 or more feet. So occasionally we used to go down there and work this little pump. Funny story, there was an old chappy called Matthew Geldert. He used to keep a few hens down there. I don't know whether the wife remembers him, but he was an old chap, 70 or 80, in the 30s, and these hens used to come round, any crumbs of lunch, there was no canteens in those days, and there was a chappy called Alf Kipling, often used to go to this pump. These were during the bad times, during the 30s, and Alf used to feed these, but he would only feed the cockerel. He said, "That's my Christmas dinner." And by Jove, the cockerel disappeared at Christmas. I wouldn't vouch where it went, but... and there were hard times, because behind Violet, pumping station, of course, there was a cooling reservoir for the condensate to cool. And one year there was a swan on it. And I don't, this fellow would be dead. They called him Devro. That was his Christmas dinner. The royal swan. I just forget his Christian name, but they called him Devro. Lived in those little cottages opposite where we started married life at Chapel Street. Some little cottages there. Don't know whether that's applicable to what you want to know.
It's all interesting.
Eh?
It's all interesting.
It's all interesting. I could, fair enough, as I would say, the chappy that told the tale to me wasn't one for elaborating.
No.
He called him Jackie Barnes. He'd served his time. He was a chappy that was older than me, and he'd served his apprenticeship at Askham Ironworks.
Mm.
And then when they had taken over, he'd gone to Roanhead, and of course, this Hunter chappy was probably Askham stock. And
young man.
Well, yes, he was only a young fellow, apprentice in the engineering shop.
Mm.
Oh no, that was true enough. I never doubted it. It was
sat on the valve, was he?
It was sat on the safety valve of an air receiver. That was, you know what I mean? The receiver, yeah, where they stored the compressed air, you know, to take the pulse out of it. Because they were all the compressed air, the compressors in those days were all reciprocating. Horizontal, and mainly Ingersoll Rand in those days, but the Ingersoll Rand and
still pretty
Ali McLaren and there was a third one that was common. Doesn't matter.
What was the point of sitting on the safety valve?
So they could get a bit more pressure and it wouldn't blow off. See how much pressure they could build up with the engine. So they were all experimenting with the compressed air in those days.
Yeah.
And the compressor itself was common enough to get about 120.
Yes, sir.
But I'm talking about probably 20 years previous to that, when this happened, would probably be in about 1910, probably before the First World War.
Well, if it was Jackie Barnes that told you the story, it would be true.
Yes, he was.
He
wouldn't elaborate.
Well, funny enough, I was talking to someone else who heard the story.
Yes.
From, you know, and this is somebody who never worked there or anything, had heard something of it. You know.
Yes, well. And it was Huey that gave the order, you know what I mean? He would only be a young fellow in those days, you know, and his father would be still alive, old Miles. But go on, see how much we can get, you know what I mean? It's like, you know.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. It was a cast iron receiver, and it burst.
He was all right for Stuart.
Oh, Huey was all right.
Yeah.
He was a great big tomboy, wasn't he?
Yes. An overgrown schoolboy.
I can tell a funny story that about him. During the first year of the war, there was a great big snow around here. You think we might have had a bad winter now, but there's about 6 or 8 feet generally.
Mm.
And January 1940, and a chappie called Billy Grice, who was one of the electricians, and myself were the only ones that got there. And there's no miners got there, but Billy Grice and I made it, and we just made sure that everything was pumping all right to keep the water out and ready to start. When things did get back to normal, about a fortnight or so later, when the trains got through the Dalton Tunnel,
yeah,
Huey Kennedy would come from Ulverston.
From Stone Cross.
Fairview.
Oh, Fairview.
He lived at Fairview. He was a married man.
Ah.
He lived at Fairview. Complete with the monocle, which he always favoured, and alpenstock, dressed for the weather, you know, typical gentry.
Yeah.
Alighting at Dalton Station, got his alpine stock entangled with an old lady, alighting from the train.
Yeah.
Quite the gentleman, and apologised, but the old lady wasn't enough. She weighed him up and down Dale. Said, if you're that eye glass in your ass instead of your eye, you might see where you're going. And he told that story himself. He appreciated the point.
No, he would stop his car and have a word with you, and Our younger son.
But
he was always dressed up with a tin hat.
Yes, during the war period. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tin hat.
He would stop and, you know, have a little bit of that about him. No, he was quite a nice fellow, being a...
Yes, he, big tomboy. He never really grew up, didn't he, you know? That story definitely is true, and that's a funny angle.
What sort of bosses were they?
Pardon?
What sort of bosses were
they? Reasonable bosses, part with anything but money. Yes, part with anything but money. Made out they were, I should say, generous one thing or another, but they didn't pay very big wages.
No.
And I was telling them the wages were paid once a fortnight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the miners were paid by the fathom. It's probably so much a cubic yard, really, because of the face width would be taken into consideration as well, I don't doubt, but I know it was so much a fathom. It's a bargain struck, you know, every so often. And then the miners worked in companies. And they were paid out, in not in wage packets, in little tins, about an inch and a half, big enough to take half a crown, and about 3 inches tall. It's just a few notes in them. The companies used to gather in any little corner in fine weather, and the driest corner they could find in wet weather to share out. There was only one man killed in the mines during when I was there, around about 1935, a fellow called Vic Dunkley, number 15, 17, roughly halfway up Crooklyn's Brow, so I'd say roughly number 9 or 10 Crooklyn's Brow, he lived in Dalton. Of course, all that will be in the local newspapers if you can dig them up.
What happened to him?
They're crushed by a little fall, not a big fall, but...
They bought their candles and put...
candles, gunpowder, which was Noble's gel ignite and black powder.
Yeah.
Picks, shovels, candles.
Was anybody using acetylene light?
No, there was no acetylene, there were the old tallow dips. Yeah. Most of them made in Canal House Yard at Ulverston.
Yeah.
That's it's below there, below and behind the pub which is now called the Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, yes,
it was it's only recently been renamed, it was the Britannia.
Yeah.
In there was a Candle House Yard, which was those old cotton mills. The Candle House was converted probably from an old cotton mill and things that had been going in the 17th and 18th century in Ulverston.
They were made there. I don't remember how much they were.
Pardon?
Do you remember how much they were?
No. The stunk heaven's eye of a tallow. They used to get them in bundles of about £3, I would say.
They used gel ignite at last
day. Gel ignite and black gunpowder, not a lot of black gunpowder, but there was a bit.
Yeah.
I'm not an explosive expert, so I couldn't tell you what the different effect is, really.
Well, it shatters a bit more.
Black powder shatters more.
No.
The other way around. Mm.
Yes, it's interesting.
Interesting story, not appertaining to the mines. My first go to work was when I was with gel ignite, was when I was apprentice at the Ulverston North Lance Line Works. Mm. They had Plumpton Quarry for their limestone. And I went as a young apprentice across there. And the quarrymen had a cabin almost on the shore front. When I arrived over there, they were all in the cabin, it was break time. And lo and behold, on the fire was a pan full of gelignite.
Warming it.
They were warming it. It was cold weather. Imagine my thoughts, never having met anything like that before. It was.
It's because they, I expect down the mines, they took a warming pan down with them, they had warm water in.
No, I don't recollect them doing anything like that.
I used to at Hodborough, but I mean Hodborough was much deeper, wasn't it?
Yes. No, I've no recollection of them doing that. They probably warmed it with the tallow candles, if it was necessary, but I've no recollection of anything like that happening. But this was an apprentice at the ironwork. That was my first mix-up with anything explosive, and I wondered what it was on the fire. I didn't know it needed a detonator to set it off in those days.
Going back to Nigel, how many shaft stations were there on the way down?
Nigel, I never walked it down. I think it was the last level was the eighth level.
Oh, yeah.
But I never walked it down, and there was only the last three or four that they ever stopped off.
Yeah.
I was going down to the pumps of things mainly, and we did have a motor burnout once. And so we stopped at one of the other levels and took a motor off one of the older piston-type pumps and realigned it up against one of the electric pumps. And while it wasn't, the horsepower wasn't big enough to pump from down below the required capacity, by throttling the pump down, we didn't overload the motor.
Mm.
And so it would, there was an emergency. There's always one standby pump, one running and one standby at each level. That was very true about all working men in those days. The old age pension was paid at 70 and was 5 shillings a week. And then it went up to 10, but that wasn't enough to keep a man and wife off, so most of them went on until they were too infirm to work.
Yeah.
I can remember Perry Elderby,
men's
victory as well. He found them in the field.
Oh, but he... yes, this was what...
His wife had money. And almost everything
you
she was serving
paid
for
that, but
his lunch and for when he went back to work. And she was quite well
off, wasn't she? Yes, she'd run a domestic servant registry in Dalton, did this Mrs. Charlie at one period.
And he did go back and found him again, and
she
got back
and
he was dead.
Yes, he was one of the pumping drivers at they call the pumping engine drivers, same as the winding engine drivers at Violet. The three drivers, one for each shift there, in those days with this Dick Charlie we're talking about. Dick Woods, who had been a barohematite man, and Billy Nicholson, Fleet Street, Dalton.